ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
Two, one, liftoff.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it, it exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
Hello and welcome to Global Roaming, Your Call. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Hamish McDonald. On Mondays, we're going to look ahead at the big stories to grapple with for the week.
And because we get such wonderful feedback and ideas from you here on Global Roaming, we're also going to deal with some of the burning questions you've raised.
Like, is it time for Australia to join NATO? Is that even possible?
What's Trump really getting personally out of Venezuela?
And Australia's strategic fuel reserves. How many days could we last if fuel supplies were cut off?
That's all coming up here on Global Roaming, Your Call.
We're going to take the opportunity on Mondays to look ahead for the week, Geraldine, and sort of set the scene, address some of the stuff that's coming up. What is on your mind this week?
Look, I think it's the ongoing ructions and response to Trump observably throwing his weight around. I wanted to take up our colleague Latika Burke's suggestion that the vital political tussle underway is actually inside the Republicans in Congress and the Senate. She said that is the political story to watch. And, you know, I do think that letter to the Norwegian Prime Minister from Trump, where he basically said, you didn't give me the Nobel Peace Prize, so really I don't know that I should have a great deal of interest in peace. I think a lot of us thought it was satire. We thought it was a joke. Turned out to be real. I think that was really humiliating. I think it was
humiliating
for the Americans. I think it was humiliating for the American body politic to have something like that go out. This is my instinct that it was, I mean, humiliation is a very effective, ridicule is a very effective tool in politics. And I suspect it played quite a role, like people like Mike Johnson, the Speaker, obviously made some remarks to suggest, look, there's not going to be any invasion of Greenland, you know, and lo and behold, we now know there isn't going to be an invasion of Greenland. That's what it looks like. So I actually think that I thought Latika's suggestion was very clever. I mean, where one looks, you can look at about five directions. But I think that I'm going to take quite a lot more notice of what I think might unfold in America if he continues to overshoot, which I think he's doing at the moment, possibly in the wake of Venezuela. I think it could have its kickback on him. No, I'm not suggesting he goes out or anything. It just pulls him back, I think.
I'm curious who you think it is that's holding sway, that's had the influence on Trump at this point in time, because we often hear that he kind of listens to the last person that was in the room with him. On the Greenland question and this pulling back from possible military seizure of Greenland, he says there's now a framework for discussions around ownership. Who is it that do you think has convinced him to take a different approach? Is it a speech from Macron, for example, being furious, the threat of a European trade bazooka being brought out? Is it Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State? Is it Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, who you were talking about with Latika last week?
I suspect Rutte has played quite a role, but I also suspect that maybe the Americans around Trump, finally saw Europe's fury as well as its anxiety, don't get me wrong. But I think that the Europeans gave a whole lot of very good reasons, like, for instance, the fact that the Danes stood beside the US after September the 11th in Afghanistan, lost more people than anybody else per capita and were totally and utterly loyal. Like, these sorts of things gradually come into the conversation. And I suspect people around Trump might have said, okay, enough, enough. Now, I'm guessing because it's very difficult to read it, but something definitely pulled him back.
The topic I'd like to place on the agenda for us this week, Geraldine, is Hizbut Tahrir. So this group that the Prime Minister has specifically said he intends to ban as a result of the implementation of these new hate speech laws. And I think it is worth us taking a moment to talk about what Hizbut Tahrir is, where it comes from, what it wants, and why it has such a presence here in Australia.
Yes, they're a group that have been talked about for many years. I think they were actually outlawed in the Middle East way back in the 70s and early 80s, but not in the Western world.
Yeah, and so in more recent years, they have been banned in a number of countries. The UK, Germany, India have already banned them. But actually, what's particularly interesting about this story is the fact that because this group was banned in various parts of the Middle East, it was to Europe and the West that they moved their operations to, in a sense, exploit the freedoms, the possibility of free speech and prosecution of ideas that has enabled them to take hold and take root. I think, you know, the difficulty here is that unlike groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they haven't necessarily tended to explicitly argue for violent actions, nor have they necessarily carried them out in the same way that ISIS or Al-Qaeda have. And to that extent, have stayed within the law. So promotion of these ideas without necessarily calling on people to act or themselves acting.
Yes, it's very interesting. They're quite shape-shifting, really. And the Australian's Amanda Hodge, a very, very good correspondent in my view, she put out an interesting article and makes the point that that exploitation of Western freedoms is vaguely devastating to face, isn't it? I mean, and I think this is what is really going to be part of the conversation we're going to have with this Royal Commission, whether our precious openness, whether it invites people to take massive advantage of it, and then how we reform that, or how we put guardrails that allow free speech, but free speech with some qualifications.
Yeah. I think it's worth telling listeners a little bit about Hizbut Tahrir. So it means, it translates as the Party of Liberation, and it does disavow violence explicitly. Its ambition is to establish a caliphate, Sharia-based caliphate. But I think what distinguishes it really from other jihadist organisations, as I read it, and there's a bit about this on the Middle East Forum, we'll post that in the show notes, is that they have this longer-term strategy. They talk about ideological subversion, social mobilisation, and eventually political capture of the discourse. And that is quite distinct from groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and clearly that's what they've been able to do in Western Europe, in the UK and here in Australia to some extent within certain communities.
It's funny, I remember years ago in the UK hearing a man who had been sort of converted to Hizbut Tahrir, he'd emerged from it. He was very eloquent, and he warned, I think warn is the right verb, he warned a lot of families whose sons may have been interested what they could be getting into. So it sort of, well, I found it very persuasive quite a few years ago, and I've never forgotten it.
I think we're going to be talking a lot more about Hizbut Tahrir because, of course, the group is stripping a lot of its literature, its language from its websites. They've already said that they're talking to their lawyers about possible challenges to these new laws. And I guess the broader question is, you can formally ban a group, however you designate it, whether it's Hizbut Tahrir or a neo-Nazi group, but those people still exist, those ideas still exist, and that's the bigger challenge that Australia must now confront.
Indeed.
Hello?
Questions to the Prime Minister.
I don't know anything about it, I'd have to check, but we'll get back to you on that.
Hello, good afternoon, it's Boris Johnson here.
Thanks for your inquiry, but I'm not going to comment.
Please explain.
Okay, to our first question, Brenton Taylor asks, in light of the USA's growing clear lack of values-based international behaviour, particularly as illustrated by the latest US tilt to buy Greenland, should Australia become a full member of NATO or at least increase ties with Canada?
Well, probably it's worth spelling out what NATO stands for, just as a starting point, which is North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was established back in 1949. Now, it's a military alliance, 32 member states, 30 of them in Europe and two in North America, obviously the USA and Canada. So just from a very fundamental and geographic point of view, Australia doesn't neatly fit into that, Geraldine.
No, but it is true that based on Article 10 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which and the parties can sort of use that as their backdrop, they can unanimously invite any European country to join if they think it furthers the treaty's principles. And they can ramp up, as I understand it, the relationship with non-NATO partners. And we clearly fall into that category. We're one of these enhanced opportunities partner. We've contributed closely to, for instance, Afghanistan, Iraq. We've got a very strong partnership program focusing on interoperability. And we cooperate very closely. We're a major non-NATO ally.
Yeah.
Now, is that sufficient?
Well, I was reflecting on this from my years reporting in Afghanistan, and I used to go jogging in the morning on the NATO base, which was actually called the ISAF base at the time in Kabul. So I'd get dropped off there, go and run laps because it was safe to do it there. But so that acronym stood for International Security Assistance Force, of which Australia was a part. It was a functioning member of that. That was the formal mechanism, I guess, through which Australia contributed to the coalition in Afghanistan. There's plenty of examples, as you've pointed out, of this. Does Australia therefore need to be a full member anyway in order to participate in this way and to receive perhaps some of the in-kind return favours?
Well, quite. You know, this is always, as you know, that question of whether Australia is asked to fight other people's wars has dominated our history and our politics for more than a century. So,
And I suppose, to my mind, given the questions we have about the reliability of AUKUS, for example, mm-hmm. and our relationship, bilateral relationship with the United States, why would we be going into another multilateral security agreement of which the United States is supposed to be a key pillar, you know, for the Europeans at the moment? They're asking what happens if Trump did try to take Greenland, for example. What's the point of NATO? I actually thought it was really interesting. I listened to your episode of Global Roaming last week with Latika, where you interviewed Ioana Lungescu, a NATO expert. And it really stood out to me, her suggestion that she actually expects NATO will lean more into partnerships with countries like Australia, given the pressures and the existential questions that it's facing.
Let's have a listen.
I think we're seeing a gradual shift to regional groupings, coalitions of the willing, including with partners, important partners such as Australia, which of course is a long-standing partner to NATO, based on working together in NATO on what we know as interoperability, but perhaps outside or only partly within NATO itself. And that's what we see with the coalition of the willing for Ukraine. And I think ultimately people will also be looking to Germany in particular, which will soon have the biggest conventional armed forces in Europe and is investing massively in defense. So we are seeing a very fast shifting landscape when it comes to security and defense, where certainly the Europeans need to take on much more of the burden of their own defense in whatever format.
We are starting to hear, Geraldine, more references to things like minilateralism as opposed to multilateralism, so smaller groupings. I think the other feature to consider is that often these minilateral or multilateral arrangements might be more subject or outcome based. So identifying the areas in which you can work with another country or another set of countries, acknowledging that there'll be other realms, whether it's defence or climate or energy, where you find it more difficult. I think certainly in our region, that's going to be happening more. You know, we're going to lock in with the Indonesians and the Malaysians on some issues and then try and work with China on others.
Yes, I think that's right. And that goes back to my point. I just don't think the Australian population is nearly ready for this conversation because no one has led it. It's just not there. I find it staggering. You know, I must say, I find the void with nobody in power sort of saying, this is the debate we have to have. Honestly, I think Paul Keating would have had it, if you know what I mean. It's not easy. There's no easy answers, but you've got to draw people.
Can you please call Mr. Keating? I still want to do an episode with him, Geraldine.
Yes.
Doesn't take my calls, he takes yours.
We will see. Work in progress.
Shall we get to our next question? Kaz wants to know, what Trump will be getting out of the Venezuela takeover? Whilst he does love power and there is the possible, probable distraction from the Epstein file release, one of the main motivations is amassing wealth at any cost. My hunch is that he plans to skim off millions personally from the oil sales and companies. Obviously, no evidence that we can see necessarily of that, Kaz, is the first thing to note. But certainly, there is a lot at stake, isn't there, Geraldine?
Yes, there certainly is. And people are writing about it. There's also, to me, there's a lot of pussyfooting around it too, if I can put it that way.
How do you mean?
Oh, I think there's still a lot of political commentary in America that dodges this. Now, I just feel this all contributes to this utterly febrile international climate, although I did see a lovely line that we are also probably likely to see the slow burn of uncertainty. You know, that fact that he's on, off, up, down, it's like the giants off the loose, what happens next. Now, I think that will start to take its toll.
We're going to post this in the show notes, but there's an interesting piece written in Forbes. Here's what it says. For Trump, some newfound wealth has been coming out of another class of assets that's done well since the weekend, as in what happened in Venezuela when this was written. Cryptocurrencies, especially ones tied to the president, and he owns a lot of them. Since the Venezuela raid, Forbes estimates that the value of his crypto-related holdings is up about $140 million in all.
Yes, that was rather extraordinary to hear. But there's also this question of whether the businesses in America who are actually have to answer to boards and to shareholders, whether they're necessarily going to take part in what Trump wants them to do. Like back in November, for instance, a Republican representative, Maria Salazar, appeared on Fox Business very bluntly, making some pretty bold claims about what American oil companies would get out of an invasion of Venezuela.
Venezuela, for the American oil companies, will be a field day because it will be more than $1 trillion in economic activity.
Now, in fact, his efforts or hers and his efforts to sort of get the energy titans in there, massively sort of plunging huge amounts of money into to restart the Venezuelan oil industry, haven't really gone terribly well.
Yeah, I think it's worth drawing listeners to the commentary of the chief executive of ExxonMobil. Darren Woods is his name. He's been fairly blunt about it in relation to the possibility of returning to Venezuela. He says,
we have a very long history in Venezuela. In fact, we first got into Venezuela back in the 1940s. We've had our assets seized there twice. And so you can imagine to re-enter a third time would require some pretty significant changes from what we've historically seen here and what is currently the state. If we look at the legal and commercial constructs and frameworks in place today in Venezuela, today it's uninvestable. And so significant changes have to be made to those commercial frameworks, the legal system. There has to be durable investment protections, and there has to be a change to the hydrocarbon laws in the country.
It's a pretty... Well, yeah, if Trump was hoping for sort of quick access for American oil companies,
they're cautiously standing back. And look, there's also a fascinating part of a Financial Review article, which I also heard a podcast on. There's a serious commercial challenge in that the oil in Venezuela is much heavier than the lighter, sweeter crudes found in US shale and across the Middle East. And so it requires more inputs and even costlier processing. And there are quotes about it, sort of just the various costs of $80 to $90 a barrel to produce this heavy crude, but whereas the global price has been hovering around $60 a barrel for months. However, I've also heard other podcasts suggesting that this is rich crude. that is very desired and can be, that there's nothing quite like it. It's in very, very high quality in Venezuela. So honestly, I'm a little bit confused as to exactly what that Venezuela oil industry looks and feels like.
All right, we've got another question on the topic of fuel, and it comes from Len Pugh in Launceston in Tassie. G'day, Len. He asks, I'd like to draw your attention to something I think is being missed in all the discussions regarding the purchase of nuclear submarines and the announcement that billions of dollars are to be spent on nuclear bases in WA. That is, any major conflict with an adversary, i.e. China, is unlikely to repeat the mistake the Japanese made in World War II when they neglected to take out the fuel depots in Hawaii. Our overdependence on refined fuel coming in from Singapore with about 4 weeks' supply on hand here would surely make that supply a target and a priority for any foe, thereby crippling Australia very early on. So Len, of course, piqued our interest and got us wanting to know more about Australia's refined fuel supplies and whether this is actually a major security vulnerability. We do get people writing to us about it from time to time, and it is a genuine issue, isn't it, Jerry?
Well, it turns out that Len's actually right, that most of our refined fuel is imported, and not just from Singapore, but from other Asian countries like Japan and South Korea. And one commentator rather cutely said, Australia really does run on the smell of an oily rag.
Bob Catter has lots of pet issues, and it turns out that this is one of them.
If we run out of fuel here for 2 or 3 months, I have to tell you, you're going to have to walk to your local supermarket in the fond hope that there's been enough fuel in the transport trucks to bring the food into your supermarket. So a very diabolical situation will arise in Australia.
Yes, it turns out we import about 90% of our liquid fuel, and we have just 2 operational oil refineries. There used to be 8, and they only run on federal government support. And I might add, if you talk to any people who've been soldiers or are still soldiers, this is one of the first things they talk about to you. They really rank it highly that they think we could be stranded. And in fact, there has been quite a bit of money put in, hasn't there, into trying to ramp this up to get our capacities.
There certainly has been. And I think it's worth just looking at the number of days, because that's what gets talked about. How many days of fuel supply does Australia actually have? The federal government's Australian Petroleum statistics state that if there were a market failure, we've got 22 days worth of diesel in reserve. The International Energy Agency, though, says that the obligation is to hold 90 days worth of oil stocks. And according to the latest Australian Petroleum statistics from November, we've got 47 days worth of net import coverage. So that's total imports minus exports, including 22 days for diesel, 19 for jet fuel, and 28 for petroleum consumption. So there's a few numbers there, but I guess the sort of short end of that story is that we're falling well short of the international obligations.
I should add that in 2020, the former Coalition Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, invested $200 million on our behalf in a competitive grants program to build an extra 780 megalitres of onshore diesel fuel offshore. And so, and there were other issues too to sort of help shore up Australia's 2 remaining fuel refineries in Geelong and Brisbane. So, I mean, thank you very much indeed, Len, for raising this, because it is really quite an important issue. And if people want to sort of quickly look at something to tool themselves up about it, ABC 730 did a report on this in December 25, concerns over how long Australia's fuel supplies would last in an emergency. We'll put that on our show notes so that you can quickly look at that to know more.
And before we close out the episode, Geraldine, we do want to take a moment to say thank you very much for the superb feedback on our summer series, Getting Lucky Again. You've heard a lot of it, Jerry.
I have. Incredible, to be candid, because often summer, we don't, you know, when we do summer series generally in Radio National Office, often people are at the beach and they don't reply, but my goodness, you did.
It was pretty overwhelming, actually, a sort of tidal wave of responses, a lot in relation to Hannah Ferguson. Some people very impressed, some not so much, but Rosemary called her bracing and inspiring. She says, Geraldine, didn't we have a very vibrant minority government for a while with Julia Gillard. She showed us how it is possible to listen and consult and, yes, charm good men like Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott, at the same time achieving or at least aspiring to some important changes.
Yes, she did. And I am very much geared to relative order in government. I think that actually tends to finally bring forth more for people.
But you got a lot of feedback on your commentary and questions around minority government.
I did. They didn't like it. People sort of said, oh, we're very surprised at you. People think that I'm a, well, I don't know what people think. Maybe they think I'm ready for much more radicalised views. I'm very aware of things, you know. I think order helps actually good government. But a lot of you were exercised too about what our former chief scientist Alan Finkel had to say about gas. In particular, his idea that we need a long-term 90-10 split between renewable and natural gas-fired electricity. And look, I'll tell you who really got you all going. It was Michael Stutchbury, the former editor-in-chief of the Australian Financial Review, now the executive director of the Centre for Independent Studies. Now, Anne, for instance, was, I think, rather typical. She said she, quotes, felt very frustrated by his arguments, which she felt were a bit tired and didn't really resonate with her as a path forward. And so I don't think she was alone. So there is that.
No, I mean, I enjoyed reading a lot of the feedback. It does still surprise me the degree to which some find it almost offensive to hear ideas and views they don't like, because our society is made up of this broad selection of ideas, a very big spectrum. It exists here in Australia. Sometimes those views form government and form government policy. And so, you know, I take it pretty seriously, our job of making sure that there's a broad cross-section, you know, whether we do a summer series or across the year on global roaming. I'm always looking for guests and thinkers that are going to shed different perspectives and light on topics that
we have to think about. We tested him. We challenged him. He answered back. It was a very lively, rich episode, I thought. So actually, can I just say something? It was quite interesting for me because I thought Peter Varghese, who was the ex-chief diplomat and chancellor of Queensland University, I thought his was – I got very good feedback from him during the summer. People sort of said, I wouldn't have changed a comma or a full stop. But it didn't come via our mailbag. And my instinct about that is that he was so powerful about us, our need to have a bigger conversation about AUKUS and our reliance on the US. I think it frightens people. Mm. And because no one has started that conversation in the political realm, I think people just thought,
And looking at the figures, actually, that was the most listened to episode of the summer season so far.
Was it?
Yes.
And yet there was much less feedback than on the others where people feel more comfortable. I just found that a very interesting conundrum.
Yeah, there was a couple of suggestions in the mailbag to bring all of those summer series guests back as a panel.
Yes.
And have the discussion, bring them together. I think it's not a bad idea.
It's a very good idea, I thought.
It's not our regular format, but I would be curious to hear Alan Finkel and Peter Varghese and Michael Stutchbury and Hannah Ferguson, all of them back together.
And Lydia.
And Lydia Khalil, who was so thoughtful
That Grey Zone stuff was so interesting and fresh.
A big thanks as well, I've got to say, to Peter and Janet Howe from Tathra, who live just across the road to where we stay on holidays. They've written both summers and welcomed me back, so thank you for your feedback. And also to Robin Sevenoaks, my year two teacher at Jindabyne Primary School, who's written in about the summer series as well.
So, oh, Hamish.
To all of you, thank you very much. Thanks for your company on this first edition of Global Roaming, Your Call. Keep sending us your questions, your ideas, even a commentary. We're really happy to include that in these episodes going forward. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. I'll be back here tomorrow on Radio National and in your podcast feed with Kylie Morris. And we'll be keeping you company, of course, every day of the week.
At 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. on ABC Radio National and, of course, anytime on the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcast. So see you next time.
Bye-bye for now.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.